I got $700. Baby, don't you mess with me. Honey, I'm here. Everybody knows I'm here. Well, I'm the hoochie-coochie man. Whole round world knows I'm here.
That was Guy Davis, Corey Harris, Alan Youngblood Hart, and Phil Wiggins on the tune Hoochie Coochie Man. Cedric Burnside Project brought us Down in the Delta in front of that. And we remembered Guy Clark with that wonderful Cinco de Mayo in Memphis. You're listening to Undercurrents. I'm Gabriela. We've got something great coming up after the break, so stay tuned because we'll hear Rita Coolidge in just a minute.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Be sure to tune in to Radio Lost and Found. It's the show that puts the OO in KBOO. Radio Lost and Found is a two-hour media escape of found sounds, forgotten records, outre recordings, and more. Coming to you every second and fourth Thursday from 10 to midnight, right here on KBOO.
Hello, and welcome to the Pathways interview program, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal and cultural transformation. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. How many women in our time have overcorrected in the direction of the masculine? Does the successful life of outer accomplishment come at the expense of a rich and satisfying inner life? How can women, and men too, build and sustain an interior life in our driven and fast-paced society? Gail Straub looks at answering these questions in her new book, Returning to My Mother's House, Taking Back the Wisdom of the Feminine. Gail encourages other women to gain insight and wisdom into their relationships with their own mothers and to restore the feminine within themselves. Today I am visiting with Gail Straub, author of the best-selling books Empowerment, The Art of Creating Your Life as You Want It, and The Rhythm of Compassion, Caring for Self, and Connecting with Society. Considered a leading authority on empowerment, Gail is co-director of the Empowerment Institute, a school for transformative leadership that has certified graduates from cultures as diverse as Afghanistan, Africa, Asia, and Russia, implementing the empowerment model in education, business, health, hip-hop, and social change. Over the past 30 years, Gail Straub has trained thousands of people worldwide on engaged spirituality and the wisdom of the feminine. Hello, Gail, and welcome to the Pathways program.
Great to be here, Paul.
Why don't we start out by asking you to define for us the empowerment model in general?
in general, what we do in our empowerment work is we start at the personal level. What are people's dreams and longings? What's their purpose, their mission in life? We help them connect with that. We give them tools to do that. But we say very quickly after that, that's not enough. That's just the first step. And once we're empowered as people, how does that spill out into our families, our communities, and our world? So it's a very much an inner and outer empowerment. We've long felt, we've been at this since 1981, we've long felt that much of the consciousness quest can become narcissistic. You find out a lot about yourself, but it kind of implodes upon itself. So we've always said empowerment starts with the self and what empowers us as individuals. But the great part about that is it makes us more effective citizens as well.
And how much variety is there in the things that empower people as individuals?
It's not so varied. It's extraordinarily common. Mm-hmm. Like we have in the Institute, starting in January, I think we have 12 cultures, including South Africa, Afghanistan, Europeans, and of course lots of Americans as well. But as you know, we as Maya Angelou said, we have much more in common than we do that makes us different. And I think people want love, they want to belong, they want connection, and they want a sense of contribution. And that doesn't matter if it's you or me or a woman in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it's not so different.
So despite of these vast cultural differences, different mores and different religions and different and varying value systems, basically what people want boils down to a small number of things.
I believe that.
Mm-hmm.
I do.
So where does the narcissist, how can narcissism enter in? I mean, if I want to find fulfillment through contributing or through a loving relationship, what's the border, what's the boundary between narcissism and self-knowledge?
Yeah, great, great question. I think that often our programs of human potential and self-development are too prescriptive. If you do five of this and seven of that, you're going to live happily ever after. And it's not like that. Life is complex and dualistic, and there's joy and suffering and, you know, birth and death, to name a few. And so I think true empowerment is a more gritty thing. It's asking us to grapple not just with being happy and content, but also to grapple with what is suffering, both within ourselves and more if we're privileged and live in the West, what is asked of us in terms of the larger global community. And what I'm seeing, Paul, is that those of us who have been on a journey for a while, now some of our greatest fulfillment and meaning and happiness comes with this larger contribution and larger connection. So I think the narcissism comes in if we get too over-prescriptive and too focused on, well, what's going to make me happy and keep me always happy 100%, because that doesn't exist, obviously.
Right. Okay. So in other words, would you say that the greater fulfillment is derived through activities that are in harmony with the collective good rather than just the private good?
Yes, it's beautifully said. And that I think, interestingly, my last book, The Rhythm of Compassion, addressed what I called the in-breath and the out-breath. To be alive, we have to breathe in and breathe out. So the breath in suggested the interior life, mm-hmm. our spiritual practices, but the breath out suggested our need to connect and contribute to society.
Now, your newest book, Returning to My Mother's House, derives from your own personal experience. It's a bit of a memoir.
Yes.
And it's interesting that although you had built a successful career and were in a happy marriage, in midlife you found yourself experiencing a sense of loss.
Yes.
Well, why was that?
What had happened to me, Paul, is I was on the outside enormously successful. As you said, I have a very good marriage. I was doing global work. However, I was an intense workaholic. My life was all outer. I had really been seduced by the paradigm of more is better, fast is better, it's never enough. And ironically, in kind of a perfect paradox, when my father died, the death of my father caused a kind of spiritual crisis for me, and that death was the rebirth of my feminine and finding my mother, who had died 30 years earlier. Started having this dream that would come often. I would pretend that everything was fine, and I'd go out, you know, and change the world and all this stuff. But I started having this dream that I was a bus chopped off at the shoulders. Uh-huh. All mind, no body, no heart, just logic. I had, as you said in your introduction, I had overcorrected towards the masculine, but not a healthy masculine, a distorted masculine. And my feminine was dead, basically.
And was your choice not to have children related to that?
No, the choice not to have children, which is a part of the book and has gotten a lot of response, actually, that choice actually came after I'd retrieved more of my conscious feminine. And I want to say what I mean by conscious feminine, because I think that's a very slippery term. I'm talking about the qualities of intuition, emotional intelligence, the capacity for an interior life, so silence, solitude, slowing down, all the contemplative practices that build the interior life. I'm talking about the creative arts, the capacity for community, many important things that are equally important to men and women. But by the time I chose not to have children, I had really gone back and rediscovered many of those things. My own journey to take back my feminine required that I grieve my mother. Though she had died 30 years earlier, I was the classic motherless daughter, which Hope Edelman defines as any woman who's lost her mother from very young up to about 25. The loss is so shattering, the heartbreak is so shattering, that we go into long, long period of denial, which was what I did. My workaholism was a perfect way to squash down all this heartbreak and loss. So the choice actually came at a moment when I think my feminine was intact. And I had a kind of perfect storm in that choice, because my mom sent me mixed messages. She was one of nine kids, Irish Catholic family. She had already mothered a whole lot of kids. She was the eldest daughter. Then my husband, who's a social justice person, when we first met, he said, look, I want to save the world. If you want to have kids, it's great, but that's not really my thing. So clearly, as a feminist, I knew if I did decide, all the hard work was going to land on me. Then another part of the perfect storm in this choice was we'd just come back from a big global initiative, which we did with the United Nations. And I'd seen Paul in India and all over Africa and through Asia, poverty and overpopulation, and the images were very vivid in my psyche. And I said, you know, with all these things, do I really want to bring another soul into the world? And I did a lot of discernment and long walks and so forth, and I came to a very peaceful, clear choice that I did not want to bring physical kids into the world. And my husband David and I had a conscious ritual, a choice, which is described in the book using the four elements of water, fire, earth, and so forth. And I've never regretted the choice. I feel that I mothered not physical children, but I've been a spiritual mother to many, 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 many men and women.
And you've also given birth to projects and works like your book.
Yeah.
For instance.
But it's still taboo. It's there's a chapter when I'm teaching in Moscow in a room of over 100 Russian women when I mention my choice, a conscious choice, there's this gasp, and they all stand up, and this is Mother Russia. And there are many, many places in the world where that choice isn't even, it's not even in the framework.
There is no choice. Yeah, they're not, and that's true in parts of this country, too, or subcultures of this country, where so many women don't consciously make any choice at all.
And I think now you've struck, to me, on the heart of the conscious feminine. The conscious feminine is conscious choice, whether it be about work or children or lifestyle or politics. The blessing of choice, I think, obviously, we take so for granted living in the West. And now, having worked a lot with people in Afghanistan and Rwanda, I think we must take that choice seriously and responsibly, because that gives hope to all the people who don't have choice. So to me, if a partners want to have kids, that's great, but if they don't want to have kids, that's great also, but make the choice.
Yeah, I think it's got to be true that the freedom to choose is so central to empowerment.
It's central. It's the core principle.
How can you
principle.
Be empowered if you're not even allowed to consider things?
I think you can't have empowerment if you don't have genuine choice.
Right. And so I love this way that you correlate conscious choice ability with feminine empowerment. Because oftentimes feminine is defined as, you know, automatically defined as being as giving birth to children.
Yeah. And it's as I've been on this book tour, women kind of come to me and whisper in my ear as I'm signing their books, you know, really, it would be great. I would love to consider that I have that choice. But I think it's a taboo. Hopefully, with the generation coming now, will change. Because I'm a kid of the 60s, so it's still pretty taboo in my generation.
So how would you define feminine wisdom?
Good, because let's be really concrete and clear here. I think that the central aspects of feminine wisdom, whether that's for a woman or a man, a young person or an old person, are first the balance of emotional intelligence with logic and linear left brain capacity, so heart and head. I think the second is the balance of analysis, conceptual wisdom with intuition. So the concrete with the non-concrete, the visible and the visible being the masculine, the invisible being the feminine. I think another aspect is the capacity to develop intuition through the creative arts. I think anytime we engage in any creative art, we're developing our feminine. I also think central to the feminine is an interior life. So we're so encouraged for accomplishment and outer things, products and projects, all that's important. But I think our interior lives are rather like an endangered species. What I mean by interior life is the capacity, again, for meditation, prayer, silence, simplicity, yoga. And to me, without the interior life, we're not really skillful in our masculine exterior lives.
Why is this interior life, this rich realm of emotions and intuition, being so abandoned by women these days?
And by men too, Paul, right? It's not just us women. I think that this is a very important question, because I think in early feminism in the 70s, we would blame the patriarchy. All this loss of emotional wisdom and creative and spiritual wisdom was because of the patriarchy. But I think, as a strong feminist, I might add, that's a cop-out. I think that partly the dominant culture encourages linear logic, masculine facility, and we're given a lot more affirmation for that. So partly it's because we want to belong, and to belong we go where the dominant values are. But that's only part of it. I think also that as women we haven't stood up for it. We haven't said, this is important. There's a little scene in my book at my childhood kitchen table where my father and mother are having this big fight. My father's using, you know, logic and linear arguments and everything correlates and cause and effect. And my mother's totally emotional, completely in her heart. And my brother and my sister and I all side with my father. And we say, Mom, you don't know anything about this. You're not making any sense, because she's feeling instead of thinking. So in a way, you could say writing the book and my own journey has been to take responsibility and go back to that kitchen table and stand up for the feminine, stand up for the balance of emotion and logic in our workplaces. I think it's one of the primary places where all of us who believe in this have to stand up for these things.
Yeah, I like the way that you point out that men are also the victims of this one-sided success ethic that, you know, rewards it strictly rewards logical thinking and linear approaches to problem solving. What are some of the most common ways a woman loses her innate feminine wisdom?
First, I think, is when we cut off our emotion. We deny and repress hard things. Our relationship to death, our relationship to not knowing, our relationship to being out of control. Basically, any emotion which kind of cracks open the sense of logic and having to know. So when we do that, we lose our feminine. I think when we don't respect our bodies, because if the masculine is the mind, we could say the feminine is the heart and the body. And when we disown our bodies, we're disowning the feminine. I would say, to me, also the body of the earth. When we lose our relationship with the natural world, disconnect with its rhythms and cycles, that's a loss of the feminine.
You know, it occurs to me that this patriarchal society, which we've had now for, 5,000 years at least, it just doesn't honor the feminine at all. It's like I say to people, you know, the two most important jobs are mother and mm-hmm. teacher. Mm-hmm. And yet those are the two most undervalued things that people in the world do, just completely take it for granted. How do we change that? How can we empower the feminine into positions of leadership without it becoming Margaret Thatcher or Golda Meir?
Yeah. Someone asked me that in the last book signing I did, and I said that I felt it's one step at a time, one drop in the bucket kind of metaphor. And every time any one of us, a man or a woman, respects our emotions, balances heart and head, develops intuition, protects the interior life through any of the contemplative practices, develops the creative arts, stays connected with the land, a lot of the things that the consciousness movement are doing are helping to restore and empower the feminine. And I'm hopeful.
You know, one implication that can be derived from the title of your book, Returning to My Mother's House, is that one's mother is a good resource. I mean, does it matter if you had a bad mother?
That's a great question. Well, I think probably it does matter if you had a bad mother, but I do think I do think we all have many mothers. So if we had a bad mom, perhaps we had a great auntie or a great grandma or a great, as you said a moment ago, great teacher, some female icon or role model who instilled some of these things that we're talking about. I mean, I got my imprint from my mom up till about 12, then she left it till she died at 55. So my journey was kind of to go back and excavate and go back to that period of my early childhood. So I was lucky. I had some place where I could go back and take it back.
Now, you've explained how you in your life and your quest for success and for external acknowledgement had compromised your femininity, perhaps. But you write in the prologue, "This is the story of how I returned to my mother's house and reclaimed my own female wisdom, taking back what both mom and I had betrayed." How had your mother betrayed it? Obviously, she was dominated, but...
Yeah. Well, she... Part of how I saw this... Again, it was 30 years after she died.
Right.
I started thinking about this.
Mm-hmm.
But she was a kind of radical bohemian in the lofts of Denver in the 1930s. So very artistic, very spiritual, traveled back and forth between the visible and the invisible, kind of a mystical kind of character. Also very creative, obviously, and very emotional, as we've mentioned already. And then we moved to Wilmington, Delaware, which is a very conservative, upscale society. And my father told me shortly after Mom died that she, in wanting to belong to that rigid, rather patriarchal, linear conservative society, she began to lose herself. So I think that, again, part of it was the dominant culture, part of it was the patriarchy, but part of it, Paul, was her own doing.
Mm-hmm.
She just... She wanted to belong so much.
Right.
Also, there were not consciousness-raising groups, the women's movement. I think the major difference between my life and her life is that I had the consciousness of my generation, so I could see what I was losing. And she didn't have any of that.
Right, right. Now, in your book, you do have some prescriptive, helpful practices for taking back one's feminine wisdom. In fact, there's 7 practices in the book. Can you speak to a few of those?
Yes, we've mentioned some of them, but one is an honoring of feelings. Another is any contemplative practice, again, a developing of the interior life, a recognition we have to have an interior life and an exterior life. I talk about community a lot as a practice, that if we're in community, we've lost our families and communities in the days we live in. But if we rebuild those things, we're much more likely to protect the feminine. So men's groups, women's groups, all these different ways that we join in conscious community. And again, the cultivation of any creative art. I think those are... What's interesting to me, Paul, about those practices is they're all things we long for. In our fast-driven society, we long for quiet. We long for the wisdom of the heart. I think we long for creativity and community. So maybe we could say in a lovely way that though we have to stand and be kind of brave to do this, they're actually things that are tremendously pleasurable and fulfilling for us. The feminine is fulfilling, especially in the days that we live in.
And I'm wondering if you've been told by many men how reading your book has helped them.
I'm very glad that men are reading the book. And what a lot of men are telling me is we need a man's version of this book. We need to talk about what the conscious masculine is. One of my mentors taught me something really wonderful, which is relevant to your question. He said, you can't retrieve your conscious feminine unless your conscious masculine is strong. And I believe that.
Oh.
And conversely, a man to retrieve his conscious masculine needs a conscious feminine. So I think it would be incredible if someone like Robert Bly or some man who's been involved with the men's movement wrote about this. Because it's a different journey for men.
Right.
Men have asked me, well, could you speak to how we do it? And I really say, I don't think I'm equipped to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I do feel it's enormously important.
Tell us about your website and how people can get more information about the book, about you and your work.
The website is empowermenttraining.com.
Well, once again, we've run out of time. For those of you who tuned in late, this is Paul O'Brien, and today we have been talking with Gail Straub, author of Returning to My Mother's House, Taking Back the Wisdom of the Feminine. I want to thank our listeners for tuning into this Pathways program. This is your host, Paul O'Brien, reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways, the interview program dedicated to personal and cultural transformation. And until next time, here's wishing you a fresh start, full of learning, loving, healing, and happiness.
Ida, and you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM on your radio. Your spot for Cajun and Zydeco music. Bon ton roulé.
Okay, let's go.